We are talking once again with Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good morning. Merry Christmas.
Good afternoon.
Well, that's...
Ho, ho, ho.
Good late Christmas morning.
Yep. Yeah.
Enough of that. Let's, and I started out with stories from this past week's news, but we're going to be going back a little further than that.
Yeah, this is something we do annually. We look at the top stories of the past year, and we do it over 2 weeks. This week will be local, and next week will be national and global. And I do overhyped and underreported, and Maria just does top stories. So, we wind up combining those and just going back and forth. And it's not very structured, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully as fun for us as it is for you.
Yeah. So, Jeff, you want to dive into your overhyped stories of the year?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's the usual overhyped stories, you know, weather events, which actually weren't overhyped this year. They really were very real. And sports stories and all the rest of it. Anything to do with the Seahawks. But there were two in particular that caught my attention. One isn't necessarily the media's fault because a lot of elected officials were buying into it too. The idea that the pandemic is over and we can go back to quote unquote life is normal. It's not normal. It has never been normal. At least not in 2021. Imagine the lowest new daily infection rate in King County this year was in June. It got down to about 45 or 50 a day. By comparison, it's about 10 times that now. But imagine, if you will, a communicable contagious disease like, say, measles, if there were 50 new cases a day. And there is a vaccine, by the way. It would be a huge top story. In this case, it's all over. Go back to what you were doing. You don't need to take any preventative measures. And this is because elected officials were responding not to public health exigencies, but the economy and the blowback from the right wing over pandemic restrictions and various other things, as well as public health. So they were trying to balance all that. And honestly, that's not a good way to contain a pandemic, as we have seen. And right. As we have seen in a lot of other places as well. Actually, Washington State has done a relatively good job because of the sort of original sin of the Trump administration in dealing with the pandemic of, sloughing off all the decisions to state and local jurisdictions. And the federal government still hasn't recovered from that. It's still not taking the kind of measures, and it's still relying on the states, and that has crippled the American response. So locally, we saw along about May or June everything being reopened, no restrictions on indoor dining, bars are open, all the rest of it. And surprise, Delta came along and the caseload blew up, and we were still recovering from that when Omicron has come back and it's back again. And you haven't really seen any critique of that approach in local media at all. So that was one item that I had. Another was the political obituary of Sharma Sawant when the recall came along. This, of course, is a story that we see every time she runs for reelection. And, she keeps proving them wrong. it shouldn't surprise anybody by now. That she's very good at beating back those kind of challenges. She is the longest tenured city council member. She has by far the highest name recognition of any city council member. And that's because the tendency of local media to demonize her. You don't see city council members demonize her. The mayor occasionally has, but it's all out of proportion to the actual reality of how she serves on council. She's been pretty effective. She has really driven a lot of the conversation over the last decade. She's gotten some important measures passed. much more so than any other council member I think that you can name. She really does influence the council, even though she is, you know, very much ideologically at one end of the council.
And that kind of, you know, I think that kind of leads into the one, if I were thinking about overhyped stories of the year, the one I would, that kind of rises to the top in my mind is the story that the city council isn't effective.
Yeah, in fact, that's a good one too.
I spent a lot of time this year covering, bills that the city council passed and things that they've been doing. It's been a busy year for them. And, I think they've been extremely effective. It really just depends on what you view as important in city politics. If you think it's important to support downtown businesses, if you think, making the real estate market boom and housing prices go up to, you know, benefit real estate moguls.
It has been going up. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the thing. And the city is booming economically.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, it's ideologically driven, obviously. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as we saw, with the election of Bruce Harrell and Ann Davison and, et cetera, you know, Sarah Nelson this past November, it's effective because, you know, repetition is the key to successful advertising.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people believe it now, unfortunately. And, you know, this, Seattle Times is guilty of that. Any number of TV station newscasts are guilty of it. Right wing talk radio, of course. And, you know, collectively that reaches a lot of people. And
so if you're not paying attention, you think our city council is ineffective and in disarray and not getting anything done. When in fact, I would argue that that's probably a pretty good way to talk about Mayor Durkan's administration rather than the city council, and that the city council has been extremely effective, I think.
And yet we basically reelected Durkan to a second term this time.
By voting in Bruce Harrell. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so I just want to kind of talk about number one on my list of top stories of 2021 for local. In May, the Seattle Times filed a lawsuit against Mayor Durkan and the city over Durkan's missing text messages. The Seattle Times filed multiple FOIA requests last year to get the text messages that relate to the city's response to the George Floyd protests and the establishment of the CHOP in 2020. They discovered that Durkan was using a cell phone that had been manually set to delete text messages that were older than 30 days in violation of the state's Public Records Retention Act, and that her legal team had tried to cover that up. Text messages are also missing for at least seven other upper-level city officials, including former police chief Carmen Best. So that lawsuit and that whole back and forth over Mayor Durkan's missing text messages and text messages for other top city officials, and that those phone settings were altered just as the George Floyd protests were happening in the middle of 2020 is I think the top local underreported story this year.
And there's a name for that. And it's like literally called a conspiracy.
Yeah.
Because different entities coordinated with each other
to commit illegal acts.
Yeah. To break state law and hide it from the public.
And my top underreported story, by remarkable coincidence, is that basically, after the election in 2020, when it became clear, I was hearing through the grapevine that Durkan was not going to run for re-election, and she announced that early this year. But really, from the beginning of the year, she stopped doing her job. She's been doing the absolute minimum. You know, she occasionally sends out press releases for one or another action related to the pandemic, but she really has been missing in action almost all year. And nobody in local media wants to acknowledge that. She really stopped doing her job once it became clear to the public that she was not going to run for re-election. And that's shameful.
Yeah.
And she at least according to Erica Barnett at Publicola, very much limits her exposure to specific media outlets and
yeah.
will not even entertain other outlets. So she really, you know, ratchets herself down in terms of availability and, you know, is paying the price for that. Actually, we're all paying the price for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, ever since her her security was compromised by having a protest outside her home, you know.
When she wasn't even living there at
the time. No, she's trying to spend as much time in the Bahamas as possible. It's, keep a low profile.
So
and
anyway.
Get a nice tan, too.
So anyway, number two on my list of top stories this year is a whistleblower at the Office of the Inspector General of the Seattle Police Department resigned in protest this year and revealed that the OIG is not adequately exercising its role of oversight of the Office of Police Accountability, calling into question the biggest reforms that have been implemented as part of the police reform process here in the city of Seattle. The former auditor who was the whistleblower who resigned at the OIG detailed specific instances in which the OPA got the facts wrong when they were investigating complaints against the Seattle Police Department from the response to the George Floyd protests last year, when this senior auditor at the OIG office pointed out these mistakes and tried to get them corrected. The director of the OIG, Lisa Judge, and her deputy, Amy Tsai, told the auditor to lay off and that it would jeopardize the collegial relationship OIG has with the OPA and its director, Andrew Meyerberg. This is in spite of the fact that one of the main duties of the Office of Inspector General is to oversee the functioning of the Office of Police Accountability and to function as a check in the checks and balances process to make sure that the OPA is not just buddy-buddying with the Seattle Police Department and letting their officers off the hook. This really, the fact that the OIG's office is doing a buddy-buddy with the OPA really raises the specter of an old boys network within the police accountability bodies.
And the OIG was established to oversee
yes.
the OPA because the exactly. OPA in turn was not doing its job. So
originally,
you know,
yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So now you have, I mean, basically I had this as one of my underreported stories, the entire oversight process for public safety in Seattle is corrupt. It's compromised. It's ineffective. And, you know, we saw a very good, sort of large scale example of this with the, with the Chop and Chaz, protests that Maria mentioned earlier, because literally thousands of complaints came out of that of, you know, police, basically brutalizing the public. It was posing no threat and nothing doing, you know, basically behaving peacefully. And, you know, almost none of those complaints were upheld. And you have to ask the question why. It's not like there wasn't any videotape of it. There was, you know, live streams to going to thousands of people in real time. And everybody saw what happened, except the OPA and the OIG and et cetera. Meantime, winding through the system are a number of lawsuits against the city, and they're going to wind up paying out, and they already have paid out on some of them.
Yeah. And so that kind of leads into number three on my list of stories for the year. The OIG released its audit of the police department discipline process within the Seattle Police Department, particularly what happens after the OPA concludes its investigation. In other words, does the oversight process lead to real discipline within the ranks of the Seattle Police Department? The answer is no, it doesn't. Even though the OPA can make suggestions of how an officer should be disciplined when he or she breaks the rules, it's ultimately up to the police chief to decide. Okay. Between the years 2018 and 2021, the OIG found that the police chief chose the least severe form of discipline in nearly half of all cases in which the OPA recommended a range of consequences. In addition, if a chief decides to completely ignore the OPA's recommendations, he or she is not required to explain why. Okay. The range of consequences are based on prior cases, but we know that the Seattle Police Department hasn't adequately disciplined officers for misconduct in the past. So basing the range of consequences on prior cases really already lets Seattle police officers off the hook. And officers who were suspended, even when they faced a higher level of consequences like a suspension, and they weren't supposed to be working, were nevertheless still able to work overtime while they were suspended to make up for their lost pay. So that really shows you that the setting up the oversight bodies of the OPA and the OIG really have kind of amounted to a panacea and a sort of public relations way to address police reform. So they're supposed to provide the fiction that there's oversight of police accountability in Seattle, when in fact the Seattle Police Department doesn't really follow the recommendations of the OPA. The OPA has a very collegial relationship with the Seattle Police Department, and the OIG doesn't exercise oversight of the OPA. So I think that those two stories right there are pretty top news. And all three of my top stories relate to police accountability and how the city has reacted when the public has demanded more effort.
And I would say also that the failure of Durkin to do her job relates also, because she's always been very pro law enforcement. Of course, she comes out of the law enforcement community. And, she was really quite hands off during the protest movement last year when the SPD itself was out of control. And there has been no oversight of that at all. Not by the police chief, not by the mayor.
Yeah, and I think at one time the mayor even said, it's not my job to oversee the to issue orders to the police department. That's just the chief of police job. It's not, you know, even though the city charter says that she's the commander, she's kind of the commander in chief of the city.
Yeah, that is literally not true. I mean, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, not what you're saying, what she was saying. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is part of her job description. And it is one of the more difficult pieces of her job description, but that's not an excuse for, you know, abdicating it.
Yeah.
And I'd like to say that, and I said this on social media a month back, that as of today, right now, Christmas Day in Seattle, the most robust element the city has for police accountability is Carolyn Bix writing at South Seattle Emerald.
Yeah,
that is the single strongest element that we have in place. And thank God
for that. And I would put number two after that, the federal judge that oversees the reform process after a full decade. For most cities, that's a 4 or 5 year process. And then it's, you know, the federal government.
It's concluded. Yeah. It's been going on a decade. Yeah.
Yeah. And we're still seeing these kind of problems. Mm-hmm. And that really speaks to the cultural rot within SPD, which pretty much has infected everything it touches. I don't know how you address that other than just firing everybody and starting over. Like, you know, defunding the police. Mm-hmm. Just saying.
Yeah.
All right.
So, number four on my list is kind of related to Jav's, item that Durkin's kind of failed to do her job. It's the Durkin administration failing to house the homeless even during, even turning down opportunities to use emergency federal funding to get people off the street and into hotel rooms where they'd be safe from contracting COVID-19. The Just Care program used money from the King County budget to shelter high needs folks, but the city refused to chip in when that funding was going to expire. And the city could have applied for federal grant to expand or to continue that program, even though the program was designed to house homeless people from the Pioneer Square and downtown area. The city turned it down. And the reason that Mayor Durkin turned it down was because she said that the city wouldn't be able to get reimbursed wouldn't be able to qualify for the FEMA funds to pay for it, when in fact it was obvious that other cities around the United States were actually doing that already, and that Seattle would qualify just as well as they would. Durkin hesitated for 6 months to spend $12 million that the city council had allocated in 2020 for hotel-based shelter, only starting to spend that money in June after the council lifted a requirement that the city seek reimbursement from FEMA for that funding. So essentially, she was basically saying, nope, not going to apply for a federal grant. Nope, you can't make me no. You know, until the city council said, look, just spend the money here. We'll lift the requirement that you apply for reimbursement from FEMA. Then finally, she started to spend the money. Durkin has intermittently throughout the year announced new shelter beds, but they've always been in small numbers, 20 here, 20 there, et cetera, maybe up to 100 total. But that's just a drop in the bucket of what's needed in the Seattle area to house the folks who are living on the street. And the city council is trying to move forward with some of these things. The Durkin administration is saying, oh, no, we're not going to do that. It's the King County Regional Homelessness Authority's job to do that, you know, and, there's money in the budget we haven't spent. Well, just remove all restrictions on those funds and maybe we'll start spending it. That's, really fall. And of course we won't be looking to the federal government for help because that requires work and we're not going to do any work. So.
And that relates to a couple of the items on my list. One of them was something that I think you had a version of this also, which is that the Regional Homelessness Authority has been completely ineffective, shall we say. And local governments are saying, well, we can't do anything. It's the Regional Homelessness Authority's job to do it. It's been very slow to get the regional authority started. And once started, it really hasn't been doing anything. Meanwhile, this was another item on my list, the pandemic is fueling more and more homelessness. You can say that the fact that there's homeless in pretty much every community in King County now and every neighborhood in King County, that's certainly been hyped, maybe even overhyped. But the connection to the pandemic and the fact that at the bottom of our economy, people are not doing well. And meanwhile, you know, prices are going up, prices of groceries, certainly prices of housing, and a lot of people just can't afford it. And the moratorium has expired, and we're not hearing anything about, you know, people not being able to afford their housing and now living on the streets. It's just not a local story. I think part of what's driven that is the cancellation over the last couple of years of the point in time count. So there's no numbers that reporters can point at saying, yep, this is increasing. But, you know, just the eye test of the number of people living on the street and a number of different places where people are living on the street should tell you that it is a severe crisis. It's not getting better. And, you know, business as usual is not going to cut it. And I'm afraid that's what we're going to get out of the Harrell administration. That or, well, we can't do anything. It's the regional authority's responsibility. Well, and then they don't do anything.
And they just had a memorial in downtown a couple weeks back for a record number of homeless deaths this year.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is, you know.
And of course, you know, the second riskiest part of the year after the heat wave this summer, which we'll talk about in a minute, is record cold, which is what we're getting this coming week. So the city has opened emergency shelters. City Hall is one, Seattle Center, and a number of different, you know, scattered places around the city. And this would be a great time if you're feeling in the Christmas spirit to go to your local service provider and, drop off some, blankets, jackets.
Coats.
Socks are a big one. Socks are a big one. You know, re-gift those socks you got for Christmas. You know, it's an important time to keep people warm.
Actually, did they actually open City Hall itself yet? Because two days ago they hadn't.
No. So, no. They're doing it. They're doing it either tonight or tomorrow night.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, my understanding is they were opening two shelters, one of which is just kind of down the street from me at the Seattle Center.
Right.
But they weren't going to, that they didn't have plans to open City Hall, which I think is crazy because the shelter space they're providing, additional shelter space they're providing is not nearly enough for all the people who are living on the street.
No, it's not. I got the City Hall off of a Seattle Times story last night, so.
Okay, so maybe they changed their mind.
Yeah.
Okay.
Finally. And delaying things until Christmas. I mean, it was already starting to get cold. And also pointing out that most of these facilities are only available during the evening hours and overnight. They're not even available during the day. They expect people to go out. The city's solution is to go out and use the libraries for heating, which are not adequate and have limited hours themselves.
Here in my neighborhood in Lower Queen Anne, they're opening a shelter at the Seattle Center that closes at 7 a.m. And then they open
a
day.
It's not even light at 7 a.m.
Right. And then they open a day shelter, but that isn't going to open for like 3 or 4 hours after they close the night shelter at 7 a.m. So people who are homeless have to spend 3 or 4 hours in the cold and possibly in the snow, kind of walking around trying to stay warm, waiting for the daytime shelter to open. So the city's response to homelessness in Seattle, and it's really, really led by the disarray in the Durkin administration has just been incredibly bad, incredibly poor. And I wouldn't lay the feet of the council. It's the mayor's responsibility to run the city day to day, and she just has not been doing it.
Yeah, it's dangerous. I mean, the forecast for Monday and Tuesday, it will not get above freezing all day.
Yeah, going to be in the 20s.
Yeah, so it's
you don't survive that. By walking around or hanging out at a bus stop.
No.
Okay, sitting on a bench. You don't survive it that way. So, okay. So, number 5 on my list. You're right, Jeff. I have, the King County Regional Homelessness Authority got off to a rocky start. And it's been a long, slow takeoff for the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. I think very early in the year, when the first person chosen to be the new director of the agency turned down the job, we kind of got a sense of what was ahead for the regional authority. It went to the runner-up candidate, Mark Doans. Then Mark Doans was in direct conflict with the Seattle City Council, refusing to spend the money that the council had budgeted for 12 new tiny home villages because he just doesn't like them. Yet he's willing to spend money on emergency shelters when tiny home villages are far more successful at getting people housed. Okay. Seattle provides most of the money for the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. And when Doans requested additional funding from the city council to get the regional homelessness authority off the ground during the budget process this year, his requests were mostly denied. The city council members turned around and said, hey, you know, you haven't provided us any information on why you need this additional money and what it's going for and why you weren't able to get the regional authority going on the money we gave you already. So I think we should expect that this conflict is going to carry over into 2022 next year. And the regional homelessness authority still appears to be trying to get staffed up and up to speed, even though it's been an entire year. I think that's pointing to the fact that the regional authority is just not going to be working the way its supporters envisioned, and certainly not anytime soon.
And you know, the original idea behind the regional authority, such as it was that the entire region is experiencing homelessness. And so you need a coordinated regional response. Mm-hmm. The problem with this is that the governance of the regional authority falls to a patchwork of local elected officials in some of the different suburbs as well as city Seattle, and those suburbs are much more reluctant to take the kind of action that is needed to solve the housing crisis, which, after all, is what is driving the homelessness crisis. So you're gonna continue to get the whack-a-mole approach, I think.
And a lot of those localities, you know, Renton, Tukwila, Bellevue, et cetera, they're taking kind of a NIMBY approach to homelessness. None of them are contributing to the funding of the Regional Homelessness Authority. It's being funded almost completely by a combination of money from the King County budget and the vast bulk of it from the City of Seattle's budget. And the localities, the other smaller localities and cities in King County are saying, we don't want to have to follow the policies being set by the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. We want to set our own policies, and we don't want them telling us what to do. Well, you can't have a regional authority if you don't have buy-in from all of these smaller cities and governments. And unfortunately, we just don't have that yet. And it's likely to not ever come.
And, you know, given that the failure to address homelessness over the past, God help us, 35 years now, has been that local governments almost uniformly would prefer to play whack-a-mole and just push the homeless around to other communities, you know, not ours, or other neighborhoods, not ours. And, this looks like a continuation of that policy. The Harrell administration, I don't think, is going to be an improvement. And so I think we can look forward to homelessness becoming an even greater crisis over the next 4 years. I'm not optimistic at all in terms of what I'm seeing from a government response.
And business response. Which primarily drives government response.
Funny coincidence that, yeah.
Yeah, that kind of leads into the next one on my list, which is a group of real estate moguls spent millions of dollars to manipulate city politics this year. First, they tried to make sweeping homeless encampments part of the city charter through Charter Amendment 29, which actually failed to get on the ballot in November when a judge ruled that it violated the rights of city officials to set policy on homelessness, land use, and how money in the budget is spent. Then the real estate lobby, seeing that they couldn't get Charter Amendment 29 on the ballot, they spent millions to get Bruce Harrell elected mayor, Sarah Nelson elected to the city council over a great campaign run by Nikita Oliver, and then also to get Ann Davison elected as city attorney. And they were successful at that. Bruce Harrell, of course, has promised to implement Charter Amendment 29, even though it didn't go to a vote of the public. So he has no idea if the public in Seattle supports Charter Amendment 29 or not. He's just going to be responsive to these real estate moguls and implement it anyway. But then come the end of the year, this month, these real estate moguls who also spent over $1 million to unseat Shama Sawant in an expensive recall election failed at that. So a little bit of good news there at the end. But I think we're seeing what politics in Seattle is going to be from here on out. Real estate developers and the landlord lobby and big property owners here in the city of Seattle have all done extremely well over the past decade. They have a lot of money in their bank accounts, and they're looking to spend that money to try to shape Seattle politics in the way that they want to see it, to make it look the way they want it.
And, because they know that if they influence who the decision makers are and what decisions they're making and, you know, influencing things like, you know, zoning limits, that they will more than make that investment back in future profits. And they have the cash flow that they can afford to invest in that. And the very definition of developers is you take risks on different projects, but you have the cash flow to absorb losses, and you have the cash flow to get projects going. Well, this is another investment. And they're investing in local politics. And, certainly this past year, they got a good future return on their investment. So you're going to see a lot more of it in the future.
Yeah.
The number two on my underreported list was very similar to that. It was who funded the recall, because that is literally the easiest reporting job in the world. You go to the Seattle Ethics and Elections Committee website
and you look
at who funded the recall.
Doesn't take long.
No, it doesn't take long, and it takes even less time because there are going to be a number of very familiar names in there. You don't have to look up who are these people. You know who these people are because every time you do a real estate story, you talk to them. It really was, I think people sometimes tend to dismiss Sawant's campaigns as hyperbole, but it really was funded by developers. And it really was funded by real estate interests.
And the construction industry.
And the construction
industry. Particularly angry at her for supporting the carpenter strike. But also landlords, because she's been the leading city council member to propose new bills that help tenants in the city of Seattle.
A number of which have actually passed. So yeah.
Oh yeah, a number of which have actually passed and have really helped tenants a lot in the city of Seattle. So the landlord, real estate, construction lobby has just been gung ho to try to get rid of her.
And they saw an opportunity to cover,
but yeah. Not covered at all in the Seattle Times. Although every once in a while you get little hints of it. Reading if you read deep into some of the articles. You could occasionally see a sentence sneak through that it would admit that, oh yeah, it's real estate, executives are trying to get rid of her.
Yeah.
It was known at the Seattle Times by their reporting staff and their editorial staff. And occasionally it would leak into an article, you know, buried deep within the article.
Yeah, their editing has gotten really sloppy.
Yeah. there was never any, feature article about who is trying to get rid of Shama Sawant and why.
And they understand who, butters their bread there at the Seattle Times, that, you know, advertising dollars, those who pay for those services are definitely on the preferred list when it comes down to where you're sitting on the fence on an editorial issue, you know, mm-hmm. which side you're going to be backing on your headlines. It's
just how to frame a story. Yeah.
It has really been since the demise of the Post-Intelligencer when the Times became the only the only daily paper in town. And they don't necessarily understand how the internet works and that people have, you know, report stories in real time now. And it's not just once a morning you pick up your print copy of the paper. They really have lost the firewall between editorial and reporting the news room. That is supposed to exist at every newspaper, and it really doesn't at the Seattle Times. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that as long as you're clear as, for example, the Stranger is, what your biases are and what your priorities are. But the Times pretends it is objective reporting, and you can see it in almost every news story involving a controversy of any kind. Its placement of quotes, its placement of adjectives and adverbs. It's subtle, but if you know what to look for, what is not covered that is mm-hmm. often the most important piece. If you know what to look for, it's there. It's very disturbing.
Which is not to say that there isn't still good reporting coming out of the Seattle Times, but you have to be very careful in your reading of it. And that goes to media literacy. I think, you know, we've talked about this in the past, but just about any source, no matter how far it leans in any direction, you can still get good information out of, so long as you use a wicked sharp media literacy tool while you're consuming that.
Yeah.
As long as you understand what their perspective is and, you know, who funds them.
Yeah, and this is traditional reporting. It doesn't apply to right-wing media, which just lies. I was reading, and don't ask me why, it's a long story, but I was reading Breitbart News last night. And, you know, I read these things so you don't have to. And, it was amazing. The pandemic doesn't exist. The word Omicron never showed up, even though it was by far the top news story yesterday, as it has been pretty much every day this week. you know, it didn't exist. The top story was that only real Christians understand Christmas. I'm not making that up. The number two was the Christmas statement from Ron DeSantis, which tells you who the Republican nominee for president is going to be in 3 years. You know, and it just went on from there. Critical race theory was a big story. I forget what the other ones were, but you get the idea. It's an entirely alternative universe of fictional. And so, yeah, and the popularity of sites like that, which, you know, Fox News at least pretends to be a news channel. It occasionally covers stories in the real world. But there's an entire universe of right-wing media that isn't bound by even that standard. You know, and there's no point suing them for spewing lies when the entire project is built upon the understanding that people can't tell lies from truth. And yeah. That gets back to media literacy. It really has led to a lot of failures nationally in our political discourse. But we'll talk about that next week.
Yeah. And so the next three items on my list all have to do with the state legislature and what it got accomplished early this year. The number one of those three items is even though we had failures of police accountability on the local level, it was a record year for police accountability bills in the Washington state legislature, including a new state disciplinary system, a system to decertify police officers who've been fired from their departments in Washington state, a new Office of Independent Investigations within the governor's office to investigate use of force cases, a ban on chokeholds and neck restraints, a prohibition against no-knock warrants, a ban on the use of many types of military equipment, a prohibition against firing on a moving vehicle unless a police officer is in imminent danger of harm, a new standard for the use of deadly force by police officers, and a requirement for an officer to intervene when he or she sees another officer engaging in excessive force. It really was a banner year for police accountability at the state level, and the state legislature got a lot done on that front. We'll see if their changes have much resonance with police departments throughout the state, as those police departments have to spend some time in the next year or two looking at what those changes were and reconfiguring how they do business. But I think that is a nice bright spot in the year.
Yeah. Wow. Impressive list.
It is a pretty impressive list. The state legislature, which is dominated by Democrats this year, actually got quite a bit done. Number two on that list of three items is the state legislature also passed laws affirming the rights of the incarcerated and formerly incarcerated in Washington state. That includes a law that bans private prisons in the state of Washington, a law requiring the State Department of Corrections and local jails to convene a review team whenever an inmate dies unexpectedly, a law to restore voting rights to people convicted of felonies who've been released from prison, served their time, and are done, and a law to establish a process for folks to get criminal misdemeanor convictions vacated, removed from their record, if those crimes resulted from the person being a victim of sex trafficking, prostitution, commercial sexual abuse of a minor, sexual assault, or domestic violence, and if the person has served their time in jail or prison. So some very, very good bills passed this year to help affirm the rights of people who are incarcerated in Washington state and people who are formerly incarcerated and need to start their lives up again. So I think just a really great year in the state legislature for that.
So something I didn't see a lot of this year, and, you know, correct me if I missed something, was action on climate change. And, of course, climate change was in the top of people's minds in late June when we had an insane heat wave that, you know, shattered previous record highs, all-time record highs, all across the Pacific Northwest. We got as hot as 121 degrees in Lytton, BC, and 117 in Portland. It was only 112 here. And I put that only in quotes, of course, because that was still 8 degrees above our all-time high in Seattle. And, you know, it was life-threatening, and there was a death toll associated with that heat wave because, you know, not everybody has air conditioning and not everybody knows how to stay cool, and certainly not how to navigate that kind of unprecedented heat. That was 6 months ago today, and now we are looking at a record prolonged cold spell. Those things, and then the other thing that was underreported this year was the fire season. Because, you know, massive outbreaks of wildfires have become the new normal. We expect it every year now. That didn't used to be the case. The kind of year we had this year would have been, you know, front page, top of newscast news in past years, but it barely got a mention this year in Seattle. Because we weren't directly
affected. We
didn't get
any wildfire smoke here in Seattle, so it just was off the news.
Yeah,
even though it impacted the entire rest of the state.
Yeah,
and
you had
areas north, south, east, and west of us.
Yeah, you had massive fires in the Cascades and east of the mountains, but the wind, fortunately, was blooming east. So Spokane got all the smoke, and we didn't. Total failure by local news.
Even as far as I think people in New York were bathed in smoke coming from the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah. And it's not just Washington State, of course, either. Oregon and BC get fires every year now as well. And that is a result of climate change and drought and loss of snowpack and all the rest of the things that have gone with it. And, of course, the record heat as well. You know, it just it speaks to the utter failure over the past 30 years of governments. Not just our government, but the national government, other countries, international bodies, to do anything meaningful to address climate change. And we're starting to pay the price, literally.
Yeah. So the third item I had that the state legislature worked on this year that I think should have been bigger news is the state legislature passing the 7% capital gains tax on capital gains of more than $250,000 per taxpayer per year. This excludes real estate sales, of course. So those, you know, kind of throw a bone to the real estate lobby, right? It also excludes assets in retirement accounts, livestock, machinery expensed as part of a trade or business, assets used by sole proprietorships, timber and timberlands, and the sale of family-owned businesses with revenue less than $10 million. Now, the revenue from the capital gains tax will go to pay for education in Washington State. And yes, there is a lawsuit working its way through the courts, so it may stand up to that lawsuit. It may not. We'll have to see. Meanwhile, the legislature turned down the chance to levy other taxes, like a statewide sweetened beverage tax, a wealth tax, an increase in the estate tax, and, of course, a carbon tax. But the legislature did finally pass a cap-and-trade system that will go into effect January 1st, 2023. But it will only take effect if the legislature manages to pass a transportation bill this coming session that includes at least a 5-cent increase in the gas tax. And typically it takes years for the state legislature to craft and agree on a transportation bill to pass. So I wouldn't hold my breath.
And even if that does pass, you know, experts on climate change will tell you that cap and trade is by far the least effective way.
The least effective. A carbon tax would have been much, much better. And the state legislature just couldn't do it.
Yeah, let alone make the
Well, maybe when it gets to 125 degrees, they'll take action.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe not.
Maybe not, yeah. And so number 10 on my list of top stories this year was 2021 is the year that Tim Iman had his reckoning in court. Okay.
So Mike, we need that laugh track.
In February, Thurston County Superior Court Judge James Dixon ruled that Iman had committed numerous and egregious violations of campaign finance laws in Washington state and barred him from managing, controlling, negotiating, or directing financial transactions for any political committees in the future. The judge fined him $2.6 million in penalties and $2.9 million to cover the state's attorney's fees. Iman, who declared bankruptcy 3 years ago in order to try to get out from having to pay any kind of penalties to the state, ended up defaulting on the $10,000 per month he was required to pay to clear his debt to the state of Washington. He still owes the state $5.4 million, and a bankruptcy court judge this week shifted Iman's bankruptcy from Chapter 11 to Chapter 7, which means he's now going to lose his assets, which will be sold in order to cover as much of the debt as possible. That could include his home as well.
Now, yeah, and all the expensive office chairs he's collected.
Yes. Now, I need to point out here that Tim Iman is not broke, you know. His bank statements show that even today, he still brings in tens of thousands of dollars per month in contributions from political supporters. He just isn't willing to make any payments voluntarily to the state of Washington, even though the courts have ruled that he violated the state's campaign finance laws and that he must make those payments. So, of course, the bankruptcy court judge said, well, this is a crisis entirely of your own making. And in order to get you to pay these fines, the state is just going to have to seize your assets. That's the latest news for him. And I think it really goes to show that resistance to authority can do some damage to your pocketbook, especially if you cheat when you're trying to get your initiatives passed.
And, you know, given the, I mean, he'll find somebody's sofa to crash on.
Oh yeah,
you know,
I'm sure.
Tim Iman, as with most of the Trumpist right wing, is all about being a martyr and being oppressed by authority. And so this is a perfect narrative for him. I think we have not heard the last of him by any stretch, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Didn't you previously report that he was exporting his expertise to other states?
Yes, he is. Seven or eight different states where he was trying to get, election reform, quote unquote, on the ballot, which in the right wing, of course, means, vote suppression. He was trying to do that in a number of different states that have initiative processes. As far as I know, he did not get any of those actually on the ballot, but, you know, he's networking. He's trying to, work the right wing circuit and, set himself up as a national figure, which I think is his answer to, the legal troubles he's running in Washington State.
To his failure here in Washington State. Yeah.
Yep.
So I had one item left on my list, my bonus item. And
I have one item left, too.
Okay. And mine, again, related to the record-breaking heat wave in June that brought 3 days of triple-digit temperature to the entire Pacific Northwest from Oregon north to British Columbia, where, yes, the temperature reached 121 degrees. And we need to remember that this is a part of the world where almost no one has air conditioning. Over 600 people are thought to have died because of the heat wave, and the toll could have been much higher, but the local press has not delved into it. And over 1 billion shellfish perished in our coastal waterways, literally cooked in their shells on the shoreline rocks. Without those filter feeders, the water quality in Puget Sound and our coastal waterways has suffered. And an important source of food for sea mammals is now scarce. That's another huge impact on the local environment that has also not been covered much in our local press. And, of course, the June heat wave would have been impossible without the rise in carbon emissions and global climate change. Another part of the story that just was not covered at all here. You had to go to the national media, places like the New York Times, to get the real story on what happened during our June heat wave. And I find that absolutely disgraceful.
Yep.
Yeah. So that wraps up my list.
Well, the other piece that I had was that Washington State is really the birthplace of the modern anti-vaccine movement and has been hugely influential in the national right-wing campaign of refusal to get vaccinated, which in turn has literally cost hundreds of thousands of lives this year. After a vaccine became widely available early in the year and you had a staggeringly large subset of the American adult public refusing to take it for any number of reasons, ideological reasons, religious reasons, but all of it was built on disinformation campaigns, not misinformation where people are just mistaken, but disinformation where they are intentionally lying and they know it. Or maybe they believe their own BS. Either way, a number of the early social media influencers in that campaign are in Washington State. And there has been absolutely no media coverage in mainstream media of this phenomenon as a phenomenon that was spawned largely in the Pacific Northwest and on the West Coast. You know, I'm not going to name names because they don't deserve the attention, honestly. But there are a number of people on the right wing locally, and some of it comes out of, you know, sort of new age, you know, vaccines for measles equals autism or whatever. That stuff has been around for years, but it has metastasized over the past couple of years as public health measures became politicized, and it has merged with the right wing. And it's become very, very dangerous, and it is literally killing a lot of people. You know, the kind of numbers that, you know, the term genocide gets applied to. It's really appalling, and it is a very underreported aspect of this pandemic. Well, that was a good, cheerful note to for our holiday edition. We've got, what, about 3 minutes left, Mike?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So I just want to touch briefly on news of the week that Kim Potter, the veteran police officer in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, who shot and killed 20-year-old Dante Wright during a traffic stop last summer, that led to days of unrest in that area, which is a suburb of Minneapolis, where, of course, George Floyd was killed last year. So her trial, she was charged with 2 counts of manslaughter. She was tried in Minneapolis, this past week the jury reached a conclusion that she was guilty of both counts. Her defense had been that it was all an awful mistake, that she thought she was reaching for a taser, and she reached for her service piece instead and shot and killed Dante Wright. Now, anybody who has any even passing familiarity with those weapons understands that it's impossible to mistake the two. One is much, much heavier than the other, for starters. And for somebody who's a veteran, they have different hand grips also. So for a veteran police officer, there's really only one of two explanations. One is that she was totally panicked in the moment. And, you know, so panicked that she didn't even notice that she had the wrong weapon, or that it was actually intentional, and they're covering that up. Either way, the jury didn't decide that, but they did decide that she was criminally liable for manslaughter, and sentencing will be in February. And that was another piece of good news in terms of a high profile police trial. And, you know, before George Floyd and Derek Chauvin, you didn't really have trials of police officers. It wasn't a thing in the United States. And we've had several high-profile ones this year. That is progress. And we're seeing also the Department of Justice take an interest again in investigating accountability in local police forces, which obviously was completely ignored during the Trump administration. So we're seeing progress nationally, if not locally. And the Kim Potter.
We're seeing some progress in the state of Washington. I think the state legislature passing all those police reform bills was a good sign that if things are not happening nationally, or maybe not in the Seattle Police Department, at least our state legislature is taking it seriously.
Yeah, and again, all of those pieces of progress, and we'll see what the staying power is. Yeah. They would not have happened without the protests last summer. Period.
Exactly.
Story.
Exactly. And all the work that went ahead.
Yeah.
Well, we'll be returning next week with your national and international top stories. Is that correct?
Yes, you that's correct.
All right.
There's a lot of them.
Yes, there are.
We will talk to you then.
All right.
Okay.
Happy holidays.
Thank you, Mike, and happy holidays.